Welcome to the Pacey Performance Podcast. Today, I'm speaking with sports scientist John Hill and head coach Robbie Nielsen. Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Pacey Performance Podcast. So by popular demand, and something that's interested me incredibly over the last couple of years having done the podcast, is how this all translates in the eyes of a head coach. So the opportunity came up due to the relationship between these two guys. So John's worked with Robbie at Hearts in the academy and also in the first team, and then most recently at MK Dons. So it was an opportunity that I definitely couldn't turn down to get these guys on at the same time. And having put out over the last couple of weeks on Twitter for some recommendations, it always comes back to, can we get a head coach on to see what they think about sports science, strength and conditioning, how the information is presented to them, what they recommend in terms of what they look for in a head of sports science, in a head of strength and conditioning, and that type of thing. So it's really valuable. For me, this was one of the most valuable podcasts I've ever done, because as I say in the episode, what it makes me realize is that a lot of the same challenges from the sports scientist S&C coach is just translated up the chain to the head coach, when the main thing is getting the players to do what you want them to do. And also highlights the fact that the power is with the players. So I won't talk much more. We'll get into the episode, because it's a great episode from my point of view. It was so interesting to hear Robbie's insights, but also how John works with Robbie to get what he wants and the trade-off and that type of stuff. So over to the podcast. I hope you really enjoy it. I'd love any feedback about this episode. But just before we do get into this episode, I want to say a big thanks to Vald Performance for sponsoring this episode today. So if you haven't heard of Vald Performance, they are the guys behind the Nord Board, the Groin Bar, and the all-new Human Track. So if you haven't heard of either of them three products, visit valdperformance.com or follow them on Twitter at Vald Performance. So their all-new Human Track system is a motion capture system which integrates the Xbox Kinect and four IMUs worn on both wrists and both ankles. So Human Track has been initially validated against the gold standard in Vicon with some really positive initial results, with some more to come, which will be openly available via the Vald Performance website when they do become available. So if you, like I said, if you are interested in getting to know about any of them three products, visit valdperformance.com or follow them on Twitter at valdperformance. Also sponsoring this episode today is ForceDex. So big thanks to ForceDex for their continued support of the podcast. And if you are looking for a force plate hardware and software solution, visit forcedex.com. But also have a little look at episode 139 of the Pacey Performance Podcast. So that's at strengthofscience.com/139, where co-owner of ForceDex, Dr. Daniel Cohen, goes into a lot of detail with regards to all aspects of jump monitoring. It's certainly not a sales pitch for ForceDex, but you can get a real understanding of the capability and ease of use of ForceDex with regards to the software. So if you are interested, ForceDex.com is their website, and follow them on Twitter at ForceDex. So without further ado, over to the episode with John and Robbie. Thanks for tuning into the Pacey Performance Podcast. So after popular demand, we have a second take, after I balls up the first one with the technology issues, with a head coach in Robbie Nielsen and sports scientist / S&C coach John Hill. So thank you for tuning in, guys, and thanks to you two for a second take to make it hopefully work this time. So thanks for giving me time, you two.
No, appreciate you having us all.
It's good to have you on. So anyone that does know who you two guys are. We'll start with John. Just a little bit of background on yourself. Current role, things that you're doing at the minute, things you're doing in the past, education.
So current role, I left Milton Keynes officially at the end of April. So at the end of the season. Previous roles, I've worked at Heart Midlothian Football Club in Scotland. A position I held there as head of department for about 3 years after progressing up through the academy. Did my master's degree in Edinburgh, Edinburgh University, and spent a bit of time working with Edinburgh Rugby and the Scottish National Squad as well. Kind of just working through there on my master's.
Excellent. Superb. Short and sweet. Like it. Robbie?
Thanks. Professional footballer for 16 years, and during that time, or towards the end of that time, kind of transitioned into coaching, kind of all the way up from taking the youth teams and taking reserve teams, working in academies, and then I was at Hearts as the head coach for 2.5-3 years, and then moved on to MK Dons as the manager there, and then left at the end of January this year.
Excellent. So obviously you two have worked together at Hearts. John, do you just want to give us a little bit of an insight into how that role came about and how the progression from academy to first team came about, and then we'll kind of join the dots with how that interlinks with working with Robbie?
Yeah, so initially I was kind of recruited into the academy on a 10-hour-a-week position, just working with Neil Gibson and John Curry at the time. And then progressed through various roles there to head of academy, where I was taking the under-20s, and that's where we had a change of coach, and Robbie came in and took over the 20s role. So we both worked at the top end of Hearts Academy there, and then after a period of the club being in administration, a few staffing changes where Robbie took over as head coach manager for the first team and promoted me up to the first team with him. So, yeah, a bit of a good experience of all levels at the academy, and an opportunity to kind of dip my toe in the water at each stage before I progressed up all the age groups. So it was quite a natural progression from working, starting off with the 14s to then finishing off with the first team over about six, seven years.
What was that transition like? Because it's interesting, because people come into an academy role, they're on often shitty money, but the holy grail is always to get to the first team. But obviously when you get to the first team, you get a little bit more money, but obviously the insecurity comes, instability and more pressure and things like that. What was the transition like for you?
I think you made very aware straight away that you're dealing with a completely different set of athletes when you work with the first team, and that the pressure is very real and the demands for success are put upon you. I think it's quite a difficult way to phrase it, but you can't really explain it until you've been in there, that you are now no longer working with guys who you're just looking to develop and move them on to the next step in their kind of athletic journey. You know, there's real pressure on you to deliver and make sure that your service is top level and that you're supporting the team in the best way that you can, because, you know, ultimately if there's any shortcomings there and you don't do well, there's potential for you to lose your job. So that's definitely a different way of looking at academy to first team. What I do think gets lost for a lot of practitioners though is that if you can look at a first team as goal of where to get to, it's probably not all it's cracked up to be. And, you know, just because you're working with a first team doesn't mean you're a better practitioner. And there's a lot of guys out there working at top level academies doing some fantastic work. And just because they're not the guy who takes the warmth on a match day doesn't mean you're any less of a practitioner. So if you're focusing on working with younger athletes or in an academy setting, then, you know, there's real merit to that, and there's a lot of really good work you can do in there without having to take the draw up and the risk of first team football.
Mm-hmm. Nice. What was your transition like, Robbie?
When I was about 24, 25, I had an idea that I wanted to get into coaching. Started kind of listening a bit more to the coach. He's doing a bit of work in the background, taking some training sessions at the lower kind of levels, you know, in the academy to go forward. And, you know, I had a number of clubs towards the end of my career where I was kind of just dipping my toe in, doing some work with the 18s and the 16s and 15s, working at a full-time environment. And then I decided I wanted to go first team. So, and I had the problem with my knee. And I came out of football for about a year and just worked in at Falkirk, unpaid, coming in, doing a bit of training, getting my knee sorted, but mostly focusing on the coaching side of it. And I was quite lucky. My friend was a manager at the time, and the sporting director was a coach that I'd known for a long time as well. So I went in there and worked for a year unpaid just to get experience and help out. And then I then went part-time to get into the full-time environment. So I went up to East Fife as assistant manager under a coach called Will Aitchison, who was great for me because he let me take all the coaching. So I went from, you know, taking a bit of first-team coaching where I was kind of dipping in and out with the manager and the first-team coach to taking all the training with, you know, adults, grown men, full-time professionals, part-time professionals. And then after that, I then got an opportunity to go back to Hearts as the 20s coach, but also running the academy. So I went back and did that for a while, but the club was in administration at the time, so there was a lot of issues in the background. You know, it was quite a difficult time, and you know, that's when I got to meet John. John was in there at the time working as well, and we were the 20s. And then a new owner came in, decided they wanted to go down a different direction, and offered myself the job as head coach. And I decided to promote John because I had a great relationship with him, and I thought that he worked really well with the players, and we had quite a young team that had been in the 20 squad as well at that point, so it made the transition for everyone a lot easier to do that. So that's how it kind of got there, but it was kind of moving about a wee bit in different clubs, different age groups, you know, trying to figure out where I wanted to get to at the end.
So this is to pump John's tyres a little bit here, but what did John offer in terms of a fitness coach, sports scientist, S&C coach, whatever title you want to give? What did he offer that you thought could benefit the team that was you were gonna surround yourself with?
Punch bag.
Partly that as well, yes. Part of that. No, I'm a big believer that, you know, when fitness coaches or sports scientists, whatever you want to call them, when they come out of university, they all have the same, generally have the same kind of qualifications. You know, some will have a little bit more experience than others, depending where they've been and things like that. But the biggest part is, you know, being able to deliver that to the players and the emotional intelligence to work with the players, you know, to get your message across and in different situations. And it's very similar to being a manager or a head coach. You know, you have to be emotionally intelligent to motivate different types of people and understand what gets them going. And I felt that John had that. He was very good at it. Also, it was a young group that we inherited. It was a young team that the owner wanted to put together. It was the reason she put myself in. And I felt John had a really good relationship with the players and we could relate with them really well. And he had a great work ethic, which I thought was extremely important because, you know, if we're asking the players to commit as much as we do, then it's so important that the staff do. So, you know, the three things, first thing, obviously he has to have the knowledge and the understanding to deliver. But the two big things for me were the emotional intelligence to deal with the players, which is massive, and then the work ethic to put into practice. And I feel that John had both of those. And, you know, over the years, I've played and coached, and I've come across loads of, you know, sports scientists that, you know, was probably, you know, all the qualifications under the sun, tick all the boxes, all the letters after their names, but they can't deliver on pitch and they can't interact with the players. And if you can't do that as a sports scientist, then it's going to be so difficult for you to get the players to buy into what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. So this would be interesting to know from my point of view. If you were going to do an interview with a sports scientist, fitness coach, what would be the first thing you'd do? Get them out on the pitch? See how they did?
Probably the first thing I would do, or I have done previously, is sit down and talk to them.
Yep.
You know, just have a chat about things. No, it doesn't need to be about sports science, just about just things in general. You know, just get a feel for how they, you know, it's so important that the manager and the fitness coach can have a really good relationship. And I believe that, you know, within the first, you know, 30 seconds to a minute, you can get a feel for somebody and feel as if you can work for them. So you have that conversation, see how they'll come into the group and if they're going to fit in it, and then get them out on the pitch and get them out there and get them to deliver and let them see how they interact with the boys, how the boys take to them as well. And then, you know, because obviously when you get the recruitment process, you know, the applications that come in, 99% of them have got tick all the boxes. It's how they can fit into the environment, you know, with the coaching staff or the medical staff. But the biggest part is how will they work with the players and how will they get their message across and can they deal with them for a start? Because a lot of time in the academy system, you don't really get questioned as much from the players' perspective. You know, they won't put you under pressure, they won't ask difficult questions, they won't push the boundaries. But when you get into a first team environment, it's the first thing they do. You know, they want to know, what are you going to do for them? You know, I always believe that with players, that when you go in and speak to them, whether you're a coach or a sports scientist or a fitness coach, all they want to know is, what are you going to do for them? How are you going to make them better? And can they push buttons to see if they can get away with things as well? You know, so it takes a strong character to be a sports scientist or a fitness coach in the first team level.
Do you think that's something you struggled with, John, or did that kind of thing come naturally when players are questioning what you're doing and, like Robbie said, pushing your buttons and seeing what they can get away with?
No, fortunately, it's something that I quite like. I like the interaction with the boys. I like the personal nature of it. I think one thing when I've recruited staff, that's something I'd look for, is the soft skills and can you communicate and get on with people. And that's probably another thing to add on to the difference between working for academy to first team level. You know, there's so many different motivations in a squad of first team players, between, you know, boys who are looking to make their break in, or experienced players who are looking to see out the final days of their career. And, you know, you'd handle those players very differently. Your relationships with them are different. The way that you challenge them is different, but with ultimately the same goal of, you know, maintaining standards of practice and getting them to buy into your program. So, no, fortunately, it's something that, you know, I feel like I'm pretty good at. I'd say it's probably my strength is getting on with people and doing things, you know, being on hand and being able to jump in and, you know, train with somebody if I need to motivate them, or step back and give a bit of coaching if I need to.
I think that one of the most important things is that, you know, the manager has to believe in the sports science program, you know, because if the manager doesn't believe in it, and a lot of times, you know, that you have to have a sports science department in every club, you know, because it's expected. But a lot of managers don't believe in it, and if the manager doesn't believe in it, then it's kind of undermined the sports science already. And that's that, you know, any sports scientist going in has to believe that the manager believes what they're doing, and the manager has to back them, you know, whether that be speaking to the players about it and nipping things in the bud if they come up, or even just being in the gym and around the players when they're doing their sports science and creating that good environment. Because as a player, I've seen it, you know, I've been in dressing rooms and in gyms where, you know, I know that the manager has got no interest in sports science, and the players realise that right away, and they know that the ones that don't buy into it, I've got a free rein then to really do what they want. So it's so important that as a sports scientist or a fitness coach, you get the manager to buy into what you're doing. You know, you give them the information that he needs, show them what you're trying to do, so that he, for want of a better word, has got your back in the gym, and he can look after you and help you and really push the players in the right direction.
Yeah, we've been pretty fortunate that the clubs we've been to, that, you know, we've been able to instill a culture through all the staff of, you know, hard work and, you know, standards of practice, whether it's on field, whether it's in the gym, whether it's your prehab, your nutrition, your approach to testing, whatever it is. You know, there's been a real culture underpinned of hard work, and you do things right. And I suppose it's easier to work in that environment as a sports scientist if you've got that. The challenge is then lying. How do you create that culture, and how do you get people to buy in, especially if you're speaking about first team level, where you have got that really diverse group of characters and you know, and motivations.
One little experience that I had recently was when I went into I won't name the club. I probably could, but I won't. It's a top four club in England. And I was talking about different regimes, and there's been a bit of a turnover of staff over the last 5 or 6 years, and what makes this current guy different. And the scenario that he used was when they planned the monthly schedule, gym work is in bold on days when that is the main focus. If we don't do anything that day, that is in there, where that previously hasn't been the case. And one thing that this specific manager asked was, how can I support you doing your job? You're really important. How can I support you? And he just said, just come in the gym. Just walk through, talk to a couple of players, talk to me, and just be around. And he said, the difference it's made to the buy-in from the players, that the players know that they can't get away with not doing what they're supposed to be doing, because in the plan, and the manager gives a shit by turning up and seeing how everyone's getting on. So just that little difference had made his job so, so much easier.
Yeah, I agree 100% with that. You know, as I say, I've seen it, both sides of it, and it's so important that the manager, you know, even like you said, just walking through and just being there. Because I had it when I was at a club, you know, early in my career as a player, and they had a fantastic sports science department, all the equipment, and it was great, and I loved it. The manager changed, the new manager came in and said, no gym, I'm not doing anything at all, nothing at all. And the change in the environment within the gym, you know, previously it was, you know, you had to go. And then new manager comes in, next day, five people there. Everyone else isn't interested in doing it, just because it comes from the manager. And it's, you know, it really frustrated me, because there was some real good practitioners there that weren't getting used. And to be honest, it made a, you know, a detrimental effect on the club. Really struggled for it until that manager left. But yeah, it's so important that even just walking through as a manager and talking to people and showing that you're interested and you buy into it.
Yeah, I've been pretty fortunate. I've never had to ask for that, really. I suppose, we've always had that in place where, you know, whether it be Robbie or another member of the first team staff's been in, but, you know, the last club we were in, the two watt bikes on the corner, were usually occupied by staff members during gym sessions, which is, you know, it just shows they're working away and they're shouting at the boys, and it just really drives the, you know, we're all in there working together.
Just one thing that I was going to ask on the motivation side of things, and I've heard stories about Sam Allardyce and how he motivated those that were interested in money, those that were interested in, you know, league position, all these kind of things, and how he catered for each one of them. But how do you, I'll come back to you, John, how do you deal with them guys that have got such different motivations in the stuff that you're doing day to day?
I think it's probably something that Robbie touched on earlier, is that regardless of your, you know, whether it's financial motivation or whether it's trophies, hopefully you're in an environment where the players you've got recruited want to get better. So if you can show them that you care about, you know, their personal journey or where they want to get to, whatever their motivation is, if you can demonstrate to them, you know, look, I'm with you and I'm going to try and support you to wherever you want to get to. I'm going to do my best to make you a better player. And these are the kind of tools that I can help you with. Then I think you get so much more buy-in from that if you can demonstrate that you're going to work with them to improve them. And then it's their motivations then are more how you approach that situation.
How do you deal with that as a head coach, Robbie?
Yeah, the motivational side of it is a big part of it nowadays, and there's so many different things. You know, a lot of people, John touched on it. Is it money? Is it medals? Is it some of them? It's time off. You know, it's basically talking to them, observing them, and trying to get a feel for what makes them tick. You know, but I think the big thing is trying to make them better, because by making them better, it will then drive that motivation. So yes, it's good to find out if you can exactly what their motivation is, but ultimately if you can say to them, you know, I'm going to make you better, that's my job is to do that, whether you're a manager, whether you're a fitness coach, if you can get them to believe that, and you get them to believe that by, you know, having individual chats with them, you know, showing them things that they need to improve and things that they've done well, and just really try to care for them as much as you can. And like some players, don't want that. Some of them just want to come in, do their work and leave. But, you know, it's, as a coach and a manager, it's that's one of the main things, is to try and get work out what the motivation is. And if you can do that for all the players, then, you know, you're on to a winner.
Just out of interest, what kind of player were you? What motivated you as a player?
I think when I was younger, probably, it's a difficult one when I think about it, you know. I think when I was younger, probably I was driven to try and get into the first team. You know, that was a big thing for me, was to play football. As I got older and I got a family, the driving factor then probably became to get them secure, you know. And then once I get into coaching, my big driving factor for that is to try and make people better, because I always felt that when I was a player, that as a manager, some of the managers were good, don't get me wrong, but the majority of them weren't really that bothered with you. You know, it was like, if you don't play, you're not doing well, we'll just get somebody else in. Not a lot of individual work. And I think, you know, if somebody had maybe helped me a little bit more and spoke to me a bit more, then I might have been more successful in my career. So, you know, I think your motivation changes, and it can change kind of day to day as well, or week to week, you know, about how you feel and what situation you are in your life, or things going on in the background. So I don't think you have the same motivation throughout your whole career. I think yearly, daily, weekly, whatever, it can change. But the key is to try and make them better, you know, and try and be better as a player as well.
So just to bring it back to the kind of physical side of things and the fitness coach, what kind of things from your point of view, Robbie, would a fitness coach do and not do? Did you position John when you first started working together at Hearts? And did that with trust allow you to delegate some things that you knew John was good at? Or was there certain things that he would have kind of never done, and some things that were always going to be his thing? And the reason I say that is because a lot of fitness coaches with managers who maybe don't buy into that side of things as much just become a glorified warm-up guy, do the warm-up and they go back inside and do the rehab with the guys that are injured. Where do you see that physical guy, with whatever you call him, where do you see him fit?
I think I believe that football it's got like three aspects in it. You know, you've got your technical, tactical, you've got your physical, and you've got your psychological. You know, so my belief is that the fitness coach should design a program and be in control of the physical aspects, the fitness aspects, the speed aspects, and he should be the one that plans it for me to then give me the information to put together, to build into the game model for the technical, tactical, which if we can build the two of those together properly and work them well, then allows the psychological side of it to come through. So I think the fitness sports scientist has a massive role to play, because, and I didn't do 7 years at uni. I don't know.
Neither did I.
Mesocycles, REs, the words that are used. What I want to know is, you know, how hard do I need to work them today? You know, what's the plan for the month, for the next 6 weeks? And you give me the information. So, yes, a lot of that comes down to trust, but then that comes down to recruiting the right guy. And when I first went into Hearts, John was probably more, you know, he took on the gym work, he worked in the academy, worked really hard and things like that. But initially, you know, I just kind of watched what he was doing and got a feel for him, you know. And then as I understood that, you know, he was very good at what he was doing and I liked the way he was working, you know, then, you know, gave him some more, you know, responsibility. Yes, taking a warm-up, but also being involved in the training sessions, you know, taking some of the, you know, the technical work and putting that into the warm-up as well, you know, so it kind of carries through. And then just, you know, helping out around about the session, and, you know, it kind of develops from there. But yeah, I think more and more managers now have got sports scientists that they work with and they take with them everywhere, because you get that trust, but they understand that it's a vital part of the game now, you know, that you have to have your, you know, you have to develop the team over the course of the season, over the course of the six-week periods. And it's so important that the fitness coaches give you that information, so that, you know, yes, I can deal with the technical, tactical side of it, but it's their role to make the players fitter, make them stronger, reduce injury, you know, working with the coaches.
Just on that, crack on.
No, I was going to say it's as a sports scientist, your role, I'll probably just look at the delivery side of it. Like Robbie mentioned, staff with when Robbie came in, yeah, I was delivering warm-ups, I was delivering in the gym, the speed or the conditioning work on field was my kind of remit, and then progressed and did more and gained more responsibility. But then I've also been in a situation working with another coach that, for example, on our strength day, incorporated some ball work into the warm-up and the warm-up was kind of stopped. And then the coach jumped in and kind of took over what I was doing and then just pulled me aside at the end and was like, look, anything with a ball, I don't want you doing in warm-ups. And that's kind of on me because on the face of it, I was so used to doing, you know, my role. You know, every coach is going to want something different from you, and that's probably something you need to bear in mind.
So we're just going to take a very quick break in the chat with John and Robbie. Hope you enjoyed part one. Coming up in part two, we discuss the player-coach transition that Robbie made from, obviously, from playing at Hearts and playing at Leicester and a couple of other places, to then transition to a coach in the academy, to a head coach at Hearts, then most recently at MK Dons. We also discuss the adaptability of both the manager and the sports scientist, obviously John going through a transition phase from working with Robbie at MK Dons to working with the new manager, which is obviously an interesting experience that many, many practitioners have to go through. So interesting insight into what makes that work and maybe what makes that not work. But just before we do get into part two, I want to say a big thanks to Black Box Fitness for sponsoring this episode today. So Black Box are a specialist gym manufacturer based in Belfast in Northern Ireland, who have clients all over the world, from the US to Europe to Australia to obviously here in the UK. So if you are interested in a full gym fit out, or it's just extra bits and bobs to supplement the stuff that you've already got, the equipment you've currently got in your gym, just consider Black Box. You can contact them on their website at blkboxfitness.com and follow them on Twitter and Instagram at blkboxfitness. So one of the few brands out there that I'm seeing on Instagram, they're actually doing a really good job of showcasing their handiwork and their gyms all over the world. So make sure you give them a follow. So over to part two with John and Robbie, and I will speak to you soon. When it comes to the information side of things, I know, Robbie, you mentioned it there very briefly. How has your delivery changed, John, to get information across, whether it be on the planning side, whether it be on GPS, whether it be on, you know, whatever it may be? How's your delivery changed as you've kind of molded into the kind of support team around Robbie and a head coach?
I think it's, here we come back to this this bingo, mate, this what do you call it? I think if we look at it, for me, I need to assess where I'm going to make an impact into the coaching process, right? So I need to see what Robbie does. So working together at 20s, we had a blank slate pretty much where we could input our own model. So, right, what are Robbie's big hang-ups? What does he need? What does he use to plan his session? So it's like, right, hard work and attention to detail are all these things. So how do I support that? And we ended up looking at, it came up kind of mutually from me saying, right, what do you want and how can I best support what we're doing here? What information do you need from me to make the decisions about training? And we came up with this thing, it's just an anagram for wants. So it was looking at, you know, weighting factor derived from peak match values on how hard the session was going to be. The area that we would work in, so the area of pitch size. So if we're looking at intensive or extensive days, what are the pitch sizes? So instead of saying, right, today is going to be extensive, it's this, you know, I would just say, right, here's how hard the session is going to be. Here's the areas we're working in. The N would be the number. So the numbers of players and drills, T for time, and then sum at the end, what's the cost of the training session? And when we sum all these things together, what's it look like? So that was out of a conversation where, what do you need to create your training program? And then for me, it's right, if we're going to look at what is best practice and what our kind of measures are over the week and targets we need to hit, then that was the best way for me to put something together that was manageable and that Robbie could go, right, I understand that. I can use it. So when we're working together, I'll go in with a 4 or 6 week plan with the wants for the next 4 to 6 weeks, all the sessions. So Robbie will do the calendar of when we're training, when we're in, when we're off, around the games. And then I'll go in with a physical model and say, right, based on these fixtures, these travel, that's what our wants looks like. And then Robbie put together the technical, tactical stuff on that. And that's kind of like the blueprint really from what we work from. Doesn't say we always stick to it, but certainly it's the basis for planning our training.
Yeah, we kind of sat down and we've been over and spoke about it for a number of weeks, because like I was trying to plan sessions. You know, we do like a monthly and 3 monthly planners on when the players are going to be in, you know, if it's a single session or a double session. But you know, it was how do we merge the two of them together, and how does it make it, you know, easy for myself and the coaches to put a session together, and you know, like, so that, you know, a lot of the information was coming in. You know, John's giving us it, we're getting it from elsewhere, even like the video guys and analysts are giving us stuff. And I think, you know, we're trying to put a session together to carry it through so we can merge our game model, how we progress that through the season, but also try and merge it into the, you know, periodization of the fitness side of it. And we want it to be pretty simple, you know, that, you know, I can sit down, you know, and get a 6 week plan, but I can plan weekly, you know, what your weighting factors are going to be, basically, you know, how hard we need to push them in training, you know, and that can be, you know, myself and the coaches, you know, really driving them when they're on the pitch. You know, the areas made it easy for my coaches to set it up. John could say, right, this is the area it's going to be 60 by 30. You know, so then we put that in, they can then do that. Numbers gives us the idea that, you know, if it's 4v4 on a big pitch, what kind of outcome are we going to get? If it's a tight pitch, what kind of outcome? And then the times are great for me because, you know, it allows me to split the drills up. And, you know, is it a 3 minute drill with a 30 second rest? Is it 2 minutes with a 2 minute rest? So it all kind of came together, and it just made it a lot more simple for us to put together a session that not only implemented the tactical, technical, but also implemented the physical side of it as well, to try and progress the two together. And, you know, it's one of them that we sit and talk about it, and we change things here and there. You know, it might be that, you know, we're aiming for like a weighting factor at 8, and at times you can come in with like a 9 or a 10, and then, you know, then we sit down and say, hey, we need to take this down or that down. But it gave us a base that we could work from and plan, instead of, you know, I've seen in the past, you know, like, I had a coach when I was in, initially, when I started, you know, and it was like, you know, what we're doing today? And it would be, well, just going to get the legs moving. And I'd go, what are we doing then? Well, just to get a warm-up, boxes, passing, wee games. Yeah, well, there was no information about, you know, where are we in the week? What are we doing? You know, how hard are we driving? What areas do you want the boxes? So I just felt that there had to be something there that we could, you know, be more specific in what we're doing, so we could try and, you know, unite the two aspects and push things forward together.
Do you think that's something that is commonplace? Not to obviously pin names to this, but do you think that is commonplace with what happens day to day in certain football clubs, where it's just a little bit of a kind of finger in the air with what actually?
I think it's getting a lot better. You know, yeah. I genuinely do. I think in the last kind of, you know, 5 years anyway, you know, things are moving forward. As you know, as coaches, managers, we see the extent that the sports science can benefit your team, you know. But definitely when I was coming through as a player, you know, it was like, you know, it was, I don't think there was a lot of thought really went into it. You know, it was a case of, right, just go out and play, you know, and just run about. And, you know, there'd be days where you'd be training a Friday and, you know, it'd be like full-size game for 40 minutes. You know, and you're coming into a game on a Saturday and you're dead in your feet, yeah, and things like that. So, you know, I think the plan is definitely coming into it more. And I think the more specific you can be, then the more you can plan and try and unite the two together. And you know, things will change in the coming years where they'll get more specific about what you're doing. As you know, obviously you get the GPS and the tracking gets more detailed as well, and everything's individual in the loadings, you know, and it's how you progress, but how you try and take it together, you know, your technical, tactical side of it as well.
How much compromise was there on your side of things, John, to get what you wanted within the model that Robbie and the other assistant managers and coaches and things wanted?
Yeah, I think there's compromise every day. There's, you know, what you want versus what they want, and you know, your common goal is to make the team better, but your compromise will probably be on the ways that we get there. I mean, individual differences are massive for me, so try and improve the accuracy of conditioning drills. So for example, if we're individualizing distances on max aerobic speed or, you know, anaerobic speed reserve, whatever we're looking at, in my eyes, we could give everybody set targets. But a compromise that we've made previously, in, for example, in pre-season, is that, you know, we'll group them, or, you know, we'll just have everybody working together on certain days. And, you know, is that the absolute best practice, that not everybody's stuff's individualized? No, but from, you know, Robbie's point of view or the other coach's point of view, that, you know, you're creating an ethic of hard work, and perhaps the guys have let themselves go over the summer, who probably need a bit of kick up the arse. You know, yeah, they are put in a group that's probably a little bit harder for them, but it's going to sort out whether they want to work hard and whether they want to go the extra mile to get themselves back in shape. So there's compromises is there all the time.
Yeah, that's the big part of it, is the trust between the manager and the sports scientist, is that, you know, that you put your point across and accept that at the end of the day, the manager will make a decision on it. Because, you know, there's times where, you know, when you work in an academy system, you're quite happy, and generally the coach at times can be happy for the players to go into a game on a Saturday and, you know, feeling fatigued, because that's part of football as well. But when you go into a first team environment, you understand the pressures that are there, that you have to win on a Saturday. So they have to be at peak performance or in best condition you can get them there. So that might mean that, you know, coming in on a Thursday and, you know, the plan is for a weighting factor of 6. But you get out in the training ground and they look tired, you know, look jaded, and we make a decision right away that we're going to change things, we're going to drop it down, then we're going to deload them a wee bit. And, you know, you have to do it, because ultimately the Saturdays are most important for the first team environment, and you have to get the players there at the level that's best for them. So there's always compromise all the time, and the important thing for both parties, manager and sports scientist, that you talk about it and you accept the outcome on it, and then we deal with it after. You know, how we then alter the programme the following day or the days to come as well, because it's, you know, the pressure is to get them in the best condition you can for Saturday.
Yeah, it's probably something that I looked at when I first came into the job. And, you know, you talk about that transition from academy to first team, and I spoke about pressure. So it's almost like, right, you've got this job, you're working with the first team now, and you feel that you've almost got to justify your position. So everything that you're driving is to get them as fit as possible. And, you know, you want them to be the fittest team. And if you do that, you're going to be better. Well, you know, along the way, and in hindsight, you learn that it's not about being the fittest team, it's about being the best team, you know. And I think initially, when you're young and enthusiastic, you're trying to justify your position of what you want to do and what you can bring to the table. But the more you get into it, you realise that you've got to make these compromises to get the lads in the best possible shape to go and pick 3 points.
Mm-hmm. One thing you mentioned a minute ago, Robin, it'd be great to get both your takes on this. And I've been in the, as I'm sure you both have, in the scenario. And you mentioned calendar, and I'll just explain that. And you get in a club and you don't know what's coming the next day. Like, the manager doesn't tell you he's got the plan, or you hope he's got the plan, but he doesn't tell everyone else what's going on until the kind of end of training on a Monday, what's going on Tuesday. But then I've been in scenarios when you get first of the month, you get a sheet of paper under the door and it's got the monthly calendar, and everyone knows exactly days off, exactly when games are, when reserve games are, when you've got a double session, when you've got a single session, when you've got a gym session. And it's interesting that the two takes, and I hated the scenario and didn't know what was going on. But it, from your point of view, which camp do you sit in? Are you somewhere in the middle? Are you at the end? And why do you do what you do?
I'm in the planning session, you know, that side of it. We give the players like 3 months in advance. And let me say, look, it can get changed because you can get TV games, you know, where you've got a 2-week window where it has to get altered. But, you know, I was the same as a player and as a coach when I was in the first team environment, even in at part-time level, you know, and you can't, how can you plan if you don't have a plan to work off? You know, and even for the players, you know, they, if you ask them to commit the amount of time that we ask them to commit, double sessions, you know, coming on a Sunday at times as well, you know, they have to have psychologically, you know, a period where it's in 2 or 3 weeks' time where they can say, right, we're going to have 3 days off then, and it gives them that lure to get there. But also for the rest of your staff, you know, they have to be able to plan. They have, you know, as I say, they'll do the 3 months. That's just, you know, when they're going to be in, if it's a double or a single session. But it then allows, like, John to then plan the you know, the periodisation of the physical side of it. It allows the analysts to put together, you know, session or plans for when they're going to put their sessions on, whether it be individually, whether it be with a team. It allows the secretary to organise when the food's going to get served. And so it's so important. It amazes me that teams are still, you know, making a decision at the end of the day where they bring the players in or not the following day. And don't get me wrong, like, there's times when we have our 3-monthly plan where, you know, the players might have worked really hard and are a little fatigued, and we'll say, right, lads, you're meant to be in tomorrow, but you're going to be off. And, you know, you give them the day off to try and freshen them up. But to just tell them, you know, 24 hours before that this is what's going to happen or that's what's going to happen, that I don't know. For me, it breeds an uncertainty in the whole club, you know, and it's one of them that, you know, in the whole time that I've been a head coach, I've never altered away from the monthly planner either, because I think that, you know, if you have a plan that you're planning for, you know, the next 3 months and your 6 weeks for your periodisation, if you come off the back of, you know, a bad result, why should that change your plan? Because your plan was put together to get the best it is for that 3-month period. You know, so I think the players feel a consistency and a trust that what you're doing is the right thing to do. Even though you might get a couple of bad results, you still believe in what you're doing. Because if you start changing things off the back of a couple of bad results, they then think, well, you're just making this up here. You know, or is this actually planned? You know, so it's so important to have that structure, because it just lets everyone flow. You know, it lets people arrange things. It lets them, you know, if people get kids, they can organise. If the staff need time or to get things going. So, again, going back to what we spoke about a minute ago about, you know, managers coming in the morning just deciding what they're going to do. I think we're getting away from that, just the night before deciding where they're going to be in or not.
I think for me, it kind of helps twofold. That so you've got a plan and scheduling that you can stick to, but one, I think it improves buy-in from the players, and two, I think it improves player education. So if you're going to say, look, this is the set work that we're going to do over the next 3 weeks with you, and so right, our unit training is going to focus on this, so make the players aware of this, like, you know, a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks in advance of it happening. Say, look, this next block of work is going to focus on this. This is what we want our outcomes to be, and this is how we're going to measure it. In training, the boys know that they're working towards something. You know, that there's a goal that we're aiming for. So we're not just doing, you know, high intensity repeated efforts for the sake of it. You know, there's a reason we're doing that, and they'll buy into it more if you give them that information. And plus, you give them a structure and say, look, this is the requirement of work from you here. So they don't really have to pace themselves as much through it. If you have it open-ended and say you don't really know what tomorrow's going to bring, then you put on a hard session, boys might hold themselves back. Whereas if you go, look, this is what we've got, and you've got 5 blocks of 4 minutes is our conditioning in today. After that, you're done. Tomorrow, we're going to drop it down into this, and this is the work you'll be required to do there. Okay, great. We'll go for it. Whereas if you make it open-ended, I think it's kind of like, I don't really know what's coming. I can leave some in the tank here just in case mm-hmm. I get a doing.
Yeah.
I think it's a a lack of trust in the players, to be honest with you. You know, I think that
definitely,
and it's also a kind of, it's used as a fear factor, you know, trusting them that, you know, when they're not going to work as hard as you would expect them to. So that fear of, if they don't work as hard as you expect them to, you're going to bring them in tomorrow. But also the trust of them looking after themselves when they have a day off planned. You know, I'll harken back to like 20 years ago, whenever there was a day off was planned, as soon as training was finished that day, the players were out on the town. And I still think that mentality is there with a lot of people. You know, left probably maybe less so with the players, but more so with some of the coaches that still think that the players could get up to it. You know, so it's a lack of trust and, you know, just not allowing the fear factor into your players to the worry that they're going to be in, you know, 7 days straight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's have a little chat about the transition from Hearts to MK Dons. How did that, obviously you'd built a squad, you'd built a team, you were doing really well, obviously at Hearts, and you go into a club which is obviously not yours, fresh group of players, different culture from what you'd created at Hearts. How do you then go into that kind of environment and start to implement or try to implement what you believe to be the right thing to do to get success, or what was success in the club's eyes? What's the first thing you do? What's the first thing you do as a head coach?
We went in mid-season. You know, we came in on, I think, probably like Tuesday or something, with a game on Saturday. So, to be honest, when you go in, you don't change an awful lot. It's more tactical, you know, getting them set up a little bit better. Maybe we felt that they had to work on our defensive stability when we were in possession. So the main focus in that initial period was, you know, tactically getting them in a better position, then assessing where they were fitness-wise, assessing what they'd done previously, you know, how often were they going to be in the gym, how often they run, what were the training loads, so that we didn't go into the environment and hit them hard right away. You know, you go in there and you start doing, you know, double, triple sessions, having them in the gym a couple of times a week when they've not been used to it. Mid-season, when you're taking over a team that's at the bottom end of the league, it's a recipe for disaster. So you go in and you can observe what they're doing, but mainly focus on the tactical side of it, and then slowly build the fitness side in to try and get them as fit as they can be without, you know, increasing the injury level. You know, and I think we did that well in the first year we went in. You know, we managed to get them at the relegation zone, managed to get a top half finish, and then the summer was about trying to really change the culture in it.
Sorry to drive this down to my level, but whose idea was the mask, John?
John wears that quite often, actually. Already.
I've done a few interviews for him as well, mate.
that was the absolute mask. Class.
I think that was a few of us in the office. I said, right, wouldn't this be funny? And then before we know it got printed off and laminated and put out there. The problem was I didn't make the eye holes big enough, so I couldn't see to start the car. Everybody's going to wonder what you're on about with this.
I know. So I was, I think I must have, was it on Sky Sports News?
It was, yes.
So I'm watching Sky Sports News, obviously. I guess, Robbie, you'd departed at that point. And
well, I was sneaking at the back door because the
okay.
Press were there. So
yeah.
I decided they were waiting for us to come out. And I decided to sneak out the back, but I sent the decoy out. So John went out with this mask on and get chased down the road. Well, so I slipped at the back.
So it was a mask of your face?
So I basically put a mask of Robbie's face on, Robbie's tracksuit with my shorts, and then ended up getting in his car and driving it around while the press were out there. I think they took it in good humour, apart from the one guy who was absolutely raging and said that he'd been there for 6 hours just waiting for a picture of Robbie before leaving MK.
Brilliant. Absolutely class.
So all fun and games.
Yeah, absolutely. I had that, you know, that was my first point, mask question mark, because I thought I can't forget that. I've got to bring that up. but from your point of view, John, going into that, obviously, the environment that we just described.
Yeah.
What's the first thing that you do with trying to get players on side?
you kind of you try and you're going to get the players on side by showing everybody that by buying into what you're trying to do is going to get them somewhere. So initially we did things like, Robbie's right, we couldn't go in and completely overhaul everything and say, right, you're doing, you know, heavy lifts here, here and here. So we just started off by bringing in one or two bits of equipment into the gym that we managed to get a little bit of budget for, because, you know, there was no structured S&C before we went in. The only S&C the guys really did, kind of like formal S&C, was through the physios when they were injured. So it was a case of, right, let's start putting on sessions here and getting a little group of lads saying, right, yeah, we'll get in, we'll get working with you. Do you want to do some speed work? We'll do some speed work. And before you know it, that group of four or five are the kind of real keen beans, then turns into a larger group, in which case, you know, you're in there feeding all the time. You know, you're looking strong, you're looking better. You're feeling leaner. You look like you lost a few pounds. And, you know, before they know it, results are going well on the pitch. And then you're kind of linking everything you're doing to supporting it. You know, defenders are winning their headers because, you know, we've had a couple of hard weeks training and, you know, we've really practiced on our shape and boys are looking fitter. So you're saying, oh, it's because, you know, you're doing all that work, and then you use that buy-in from it to then get it going. So it's all a big game, really, I suppose. It's all how to get people to do what they might not necessarily want to do. But I think the way that you do that is by showing them that what you're offering is going to have some benefit, and trying to be real cute and feeding back the ways that you encourage buy-in from other people.
Mm. This is one thing that came out in take one, which I'll kind of reiterate in take two, was from Robbie's comments, it just emphasizes to me that the problems that I've spoke about on probably every single one of the 188 podcasts that I've done is trying to influence the manager and try to get the manager on side and whatever means necessary to do that. But from what we've chatted about for the previous hour in take one and this today, is that the manager's doing exactly the same thing. He's trying to get the players on side with the philosophy and the tactical side of things, where the sports scientist looking at the physical, but also when the sports scientist fitness coach is going to manager for budget and asking the difficult questions, the manager's doing exactly the same, but just going up. So it kind of stands out to me that everyone's doing exactly the same thing, just the manager is kind of up a level. Would that seem pretty accurate, Robbie?
Yeah, I think it is. You know, it's you know, everyone in the game or in the coaching side of in the club is managing up the way and down the way and sideways, you know, and it's for the sports scientist, like I think I said when we spoke before, you know, it's important that you believe in what you're doing. Yeah, but you also, you know, you have the for want of a better word, the bollocks to go and say to the manager and tell him what you think, you know, and say, this is what I think is going to make the team better, this is what we'd like. And, you know, there'll be times when the manager agrees, there'll be times when he doesn't. You know, it's important that when he doesn't, you take it in the chin and you move on. But also, like a manager does when he's managing up the way, pick the right time to go and do it, you know, pick the moment when you think you're going to get the manager at a good position, i.e. when they come off the back of a couple of good results, you know, something might have happened, they brought a player in or something, and go and speak to them and explain to them what you think is going to take the club forward, why it's going to take them forward, how much it's going to cost. Because ultimately the information you give the manager, he's going to regurgitate it and tell it to the people above him. And it's his job to then pick them at the right time as well. So it's, you know, it's for me, the belief in a sports scientist, yes, the manager has to believe in them, but they also have to believe in themselves, you know, that they can get it across and they can push the place forward.
It's something that I definitely had to get better at. So when I started, I was, you know, throwing everything in there. I've seen this, we need to do this. I've seen this, we can bring this in. And realistically, you know, yeah, Robbie would support me in that, but you learn that Derby game that we've got coming up in 3 weeks' time, you know, if we win that, we're in a much stronger position to go and knock on the door and say, hey, you know what would make us even better? You know, this. Whereas it's biding your time and learning that. And I think that's something that, as a sports scientist, you underestimate, that the manager is having to manage not just the staff down the way, but, you know, the chief exec, the chairman, the board members, the fans' expectations of things. And you know, you play this really, what is essentially a small supporting role in this. As much as we like to think we're all singing, all dancing, and how are you going to go about getting those things to you know, help your practice, is really down to when it's a best time for the manager to go out and back it. You know, we're not all blessed to work at departments where we've got endless budget. So if there's something that you really need and you really want and you've made a case for, even if the manager supports you with it, you're going to have to be conscious that, you know, it's not coming out of his pocket.
It goes all the way back to right at the start when we spoke about emotional intelligence. You have to be emotionally intelligent as a fitness coach to work with players, but you also have to be emotionally intelligent to work with the manager and the coaching staff. You know, there's been times when you know, John and I have, you know, had arguments, but John would come in and initially at the start when we got together about, you know, this is the next thing, it's going to cost X amount of money, we need to get it in, and I'd say, look, John, I can't go and ask for it just now. You know, yeah, I think it's great, but we're not in a position one where it's the budget has to get spent on players, or where, you know, it's an issue with the boardroom, that, you know, the funds aren't going to be there, or the form's not been great, and it's picking, again, the right time to deal with the manager and give him the information that you think he needs. You know, maybe times where, you know, you have to take a back step and say, oof, you know, I'm not going to go another day. You know, things haven't been going great. Yes, I'd love to get it, but I'm going to give it another week. Hopefully we get a result on Saturday and things will change a wee bit, and the environment will be better and we can get what we need. But, you know, that's a big part, because if you can do that, then, you know, you're going to the manager with difficult questions, but at the right time. And then he realises, yeah, he knows what he's talking about. He's not coming here with asking for this and that all the time. You know, he kind of understands that the situation that the manager's dealing with as well. Mm-hmm.
Superb. Well, I'm really conscious that I'm keeping you into your Thursday evening, and we're coming up to an hour. But from I'll come back to you, John, just one last time. And where can people get in touch with you on the back of this, and maybe have a chat about your scenario, your experience, your knowledge? Where's the best place for people to get you?
I think social media is probably the best place to start, and then, you know, happy to share email addresses from that. So probably start off on Twitter. So it's at John K.A. Hill 88 would be my Twitter handle, if I haven't bored everybody to death already and they've got anything to follow up.
Superb. And Robbie, are you a big social media man?
No, I'm not, Rob, to be honest with you. You can, if you need me, you can find me on a school run at the moment. Most mornings about 8:30. Or behind the dugout of any manager that's under pressure.
with a cloak and stife.
Good stuff. Well, thank you very much, you both, again, for giving up your time. I really appreciate it. And we'll no doubt chat soon. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Rob. Good speaking to you.
Cheers, Rob. Thanks for having us on.
Cheers, mate. See you later. Bye-bye. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Pacey Performance Podcast. Massive thanks to John and Robbie for giving up their time to do two episodes of the podcast. The first one failed. Technical hitch. Nightmare. And that meant a second recording, which was better from my point of view. So, yeah, massive thanks to John and Robbie for giving their time twice for this episode. So I've got some cool guests coming up over the next couple of weeks. Hopefully can do this again with a head coach and a sports scientist to get more insights from the other side that we often talk about. But if you are an iTunes listener and you've got this far and you do enjoy the podcast, make sure you leave an honest rating and a review so other people can get access and find out more podcast episodes that have the information like these two guys presenting today. So massive thanks to Val Performance, Forstex and Black Box Fitness for sponsoring this episode today. And I will chat to you in the next episode.